era of analysis. Yet the 10x cases were not generally luckier than the comparison cases. The 10x companies did not generally get more good luck than the comparisons. The 10x companies did not generally get less bad luck than the comparisons. The 10x companies did not get their good luck earlier than the comparisons. The 10x companies cannot be explained by a single giant luck spike. We've encountered two extreme views on the topic of luck. One extreme holds that luck is the primary cause of 10x success. The other extreme holds that luck plays no role in 10x success. Both views are not supported by the evidence from our research. The critical question is not, are you lucky, but do you get a high return on luck? There are four possible ROL scenarios. Great return on good luck, poor return on good luck, great return on bad luck, poor return on bad luck. We observed an asymmetry between good luck and bad. A single stroke of good fortune, no matter how big, cannot by itself make a great company. But a single stroke of extremely bad luck, or an extended sequence of bad luck events that create a catastrophic outcome, can terminate the quest. There's only one truly definitive form of luck, and that's the luck that ends the game. 10xers assume they'll get a spate of bad luck and prepare ahead of time. The leadership concepts in this book, fanatic discipline, empirical creativity, productive paranoia, level 5 ambition, 20-mile march, fire bullets, then cannonballs, leading above the death line, smack, all contribute directly to earning a great ROL. 10xers credit good luck as a contributor to their success, despite the undeniable fact that others also experienced good luck. But they never blame bad luck for setbacks or failures. Unexpected findings. Some of the comparison companies had exceptional good luck, better luck even than the 10x winners, yet failed because they squandered it. 10x cases got a substantial amount of bad luck, yet managed to get a great ROL. This is when 10xers really shine, exemplifying the philosophy, what does not kill me makes me stronger. ROL might be an even more important concept than return on assets, ROA, return on equity, ROE, return on sales, ROS, or return on investment, ROI. Who luck? The luck of finding the right mentor, partner, teammate, leader, friend is one of the most important types of luck. The best way to find a strong current of good luck is to swim with great people and build deep and enduring relationships with people for whom you'd risk your life and who'd risk their lives for you. Key question. What significant luck events have you experienced in the last decade? Did you get a high return on luck? Why or why not? What can you do to increase your return on luck? And at the end of this chapter, a bonus question. Who is your best luck? Epilogue. Great by choice. Quote, we should be able to see that things are hopeless and yet be determined to make them otherwise. F. Scott Fitzgerald. We sense a dangerous disease infecting our modern culture and eroding hope. An increasingly prevalent view that greatness owes more to circumstance, even luck, than to action and discipline. That what happens to us matters more than what we do. In games of chance, like a lottery or roulette, This view seems plausible. But taken as an entire philosophy, applied more broadly to human endeavor, it's a deeply debilitating life perspective, one that we cannot imagine wanting to teach young people. Do we really believe that our actions count for little? That those who create something great are merely lucky? That our circumstances imprison us? Do we want to build a society and culture that encourages us to believe that we are not responsible for our choices and accountable for our performance? Our research evidence stands firmly against this view. This work began with the premise that most of what we face lies beyond our control, that life is uncertain and the future unknown. And as we discussed in Chapter 7, luck plays a role for everyone, both good luck and bad luck. But if one company becomes great, while another, in similar circumstances and with comparable luck, does not, the root cause of why one becomes great and the other does not simply cannot be circumstance or luck. Indeed, if there's one overarching message arising from more than 6,000 years of corporate history across all of our research, studies that employ comparisons of great versus good in similar circumstances, it would be this: greatness is not primarily a matter of circumstance. Greatness is, first and foremost, a matter of conscious choice and discipline. The factors that determine whether or not a company becomes truly great, even in a chaotic and uncertain world, lie largely within the hands of its people. It is not mainly a matter of what happens to them, but a matter of what they create, what they do, and how well they do it. This book and the three that precede it, Built to Last, Good to Great, and How the Mighty Fall, are looks into the question of what it takes to build an enduring great organization. As we conducted the 10X research, we simultaneously tested the concepts from the previous work, considering whether any of the key concepts from those works cease to apply in highly uncertain and chaotic environments. The earlier concepts held up, and we are confident that the concepts from all four studies increase the odds of building a great company. But do they guarantee success? No, they don't. Good research advances understanding, but it never provides the ultimate answer. We always have more to learn. And life offers no guarantees. It's always possible that game-ending events and unbendable forces, disease, accident, brain injury, earthquake, tsunami, financial calamity, civil war, or any of a thousand other possible events will subvert our strongest and most disciplined efforts. Still, we must act. When the moment comes, when we're afraid, exhausted, or tempted, what choice do we make? Do we abandon our values? Do we give in? Do we accept average performance because that's what most everyone else accepts? Do we capitulate to the pressure of the moment? Do we give up on our dreams when we've been slammed by brutal facts? The greatest leaders we've studied throughout all our research cared as much about values as victory, as much about purpose as profit, as much about being useful as being successful. Their drive and standards are ultimately internal, rising from somewhere deep inside. We are not imprisoned by our circumstances. We are not imprisoned by the luck we get or the inherent unfairness of life. We are not imprisoned by crushing setbacks, self-inflicted mistakes, or even our past success. We are not imprisoned by the times in which we live, by the number of hours in a day, or even the number of hours we're granted in our very short lives. In the end, we can control only a tiny sliver of what happens to us. But even so, we are free to choose, free to become great by choice. We're now going to cover some frequently asked questions. We have finished the formal reading of the main text of the book, and we hope you enjoyed it very much. But there are a lot of questions that Morton and I have received about the ideas, about the work, and we wanted to cover a number of those here for you. Question. Were any of the concepts from Good to Great, Built to Last, or How the Mighty Fall overturned by this research? Answer. No. We systematically examined the relationship of the 10X cases and their comparisons to the concepts from the prior work. The evidence showed that the 10X cases exemplified the prior concepts to a greater degree than the comparison cases. We can retain our confidence in the concepts from the prior work, even in uncertain and chaotic environments. Question. To what extent did the level 5 leaders in Good to Great exhibit 10Xer behaviors as we describe them in Great by Choice? Answer. We observed fanatic discipline, empirical creativity, and level 5 ambition in the level 5 leaders in the Good to Great research, very much as with the 10Xers here. However, we observed less productive paranoia in the Good to Great leaders than in the 10X leaders in this study. We believe this is because they operated in less severe environments. Recall the analogy from early in the book in chapter 1 about hiking on a leisurely hike with warm, sunlit meadows on a warm spring day with a truly great mountaineering expedition leader. In those situations, you wouldn't see everything that makes him different from others. The level 5 leaders in Good to Great operated generally in safer environments than the 10Xers in this study. Also, unlike this study, the Good to Great leaders generally took over already established and often quite large good companies, whereas the 10Xers in this study began as entrepreneurs or small business leaders, which rendered them more exposed and vulnerable to their environments. If the level 5s in Good to Great had been leading small companies, facing the level of uncertainty and chaos faced by the 10X leaders in this study, we suspect they would have shown more productive paranoia. Finally, we'd note that Good to Great perhaps put more emphasis on the humility aspect of the level 5 duality. To review, a level 5 leads with a paradoxical blend of personal humility and professional will, whereas this study highlights more of the will aspect of level 5. To be a true level 5 leader, however, always requires exercising both humility and will. This is the concept many are familiar with of getting the right people on the bus, the wrong people off the bus, and the right people into key seats, and then figuring out where to drive the bus. Question. What role does the first who principle play when leading a company amidst uncertainty and chaos? We didn't write much about getting the right people on the bus about the first who principle in this book because the concept is so heavily covered in Good to Great. But make no mistake, 10X leaders were fanatic about getting the right people on the bus and into the right seats. Recall David Brashear's dedication to having the right people on Everest, living by the adage that a summit team is only as strong as its weakest member. Time magazine wrote of Southwest Airlines in 2002, the airline received 200,000 resumes last year, but hired only 6,000 workers, making it more selective than Harvard. Progressive Insurance identified having the right people as the number one strategic pillar for accomplishing its objectives and beating its competition, noting proudly in 1990 that there are 15 people who we asked to leave who became presidents of other insurance companies. John Brown at Stryker had a gift for picking the right people and the discipline to move people out of seats in which they were failing. Following a Stryker philosophy that it's better to invest heavily in the right people than to pour too much energy into people who aren't going to make it. George Rathman said of Amgen's early history, Amgen is one of those companies where all the assets go home at night in tennis shoes. And by the 1990s, Amgen rejected 57 of every 58 job applicants. Intel co-founder Robert Noyce assembled Intel's founding team before deciding what products to make. He took personal responsibility for recruiting Intel's early talent and believed that the right people and the right culture would lead to great outcomes. As Tom Wolfe wrote about Ted Hoff and his invention of the microprocessor, Noyce took Hoff's triumph as proof that if you created the right type of corporate community, the right type of autonomous congregation, genius would flower. Microsoft used extreme standards to select the right people for Microsoft, with Gates summing up in 1992, "Take away our best 20 people, and I tell you that Microsoft would become an unimportant company." Biomet paid fastidious attention to getting the right people in every seat, using stock options at all levels to attract and retain the best talent. All the 10X companies cultivated cult-like cultures, wherein the right people would flourish, and equally where the wrong people would quickly self-eject. The 10X study is predicated on the premise of unending uncertainty, which increases the importance of first who. See, if you cannot predict what's going to happen, you need people on the bus who can respond and adapt successfully to whatever unforeseen events might hit. Question: is there a relationship between the smack recipe, as described here in Great by Choice, and the hedgehog concept in Good to Great? To review, a hedgehog concept, as we discussed in Good to Great, is a simple, crystalline concept that flows from a deep understanding about the intersection of three circles. Circle one, what you are passionate about. Circle two, what you can be the best in the world at. And circle three, what drives your resource or economic engine. Once the good to great companies were clear on their hedgehog concepts, they built momentum by making a series of decisions relentlessly consistent with that concept, like turning a giant heavy flywheel turn upon turn. Now the smack recipe, we've come to see, is the code for translating a high-level hedgehog concept into specific action, and for keeping an organization focused in the same direction, thereby building flywheel momentum. Southwest Airlines, for example, had a high-level hedgehog concept. The best, high-spirit, low-cost airline, steadily increasing profit per fuselage. With great passion for being an industry renegade, it translated this high-level hedgehog concept into Putnam's 10 points, discussed in Chapter 6. By consistently adhering to the recipe, Southwest built cumulative momentum in the flywheel, flight by flight, city by city, gate by gate, year by year, to rise from a startup in Texas to become the most successful airline. Question: do you have any guidance for how to craft a smack recipe? Answer: the key to crafting a smack recipe is to go directly to the practical, the empirical, and when possible, the specific and concrete. You can vaguely aspire to high aircraft utilization, or, like Southwest Airlines, you can specify gate turns of 10 minutes, or fly only 737s. You can aim without precision to advanced technology, or, like Intel, you can focus on a more concrete task: double the number of components every 2 years. You can seek to be efficient with the camera, Or you can specify, be able to assemble the camera, mount on tripod, load and thread film, aim and shoot in 5 minutes flat. The snack recipe should reflect insight based on empirical validation about what works and why. It should help make it clear what to do and what not to do. It should be durable so that it requires only amendments, not wholesale revolution, in response to changing conditions. When formulating a SMAC recipe, ask, what durable, specific practices best drive our results? In laboratory working sessions with executives, we've employed the following methodology. 1. Make a list of successes your enterprise has achieved. 2. Now make a list of disappointments your enterprise has experienced. 3. Consider what specific practices correlate with the successes, but not with the disappointments. 4. On the other side, what specific practices correlate with the disappointments, but not with the successes? 5. Which of these practices can last perhaps 10 to 30 years and apply across a range of circumstances? 6. Why do these specific practices work? And finally, 7, based on the above, what SMAC recipe consisting of 8 to 12 points that reinforce each other as a coherent system best drives your results? Question. If the 10X concepts are universal, why didn't they become starkly clear in Good to Great? Answer. As we discussed in Chapter 1, each research study is like poking holes in the side of a black box and shining a light inside to see the inner workings of the principles that make great companies. Each hole provides a different perspective. The Good to Great study focused on how to make a leap from oppressive mediocrity to great results. We selected the Good to Great companies based on a pattern of 15 years of mediocre performance, punctuated by a breakthrough to 15 years of exceptional performance, not, like this study, on the severity of the environment. This study, in contrast, looked through an entirely different hole punched in the black box. Selecting small or startup companies that became great in uncertain, unforgiving, and chaotic environments. There's no inconsistency between the studies or their findings, just very different angles of analysis. The two studies don't repeat each other, nor do they contradict each other. They complement each other. Question. If I'm not a full 10Xer, can I compensate by building a 10X team that has all the behaviors? Answer. Instead of focusing on whether any given individual is a 10Xer, it's better to focus on working as a team to implement the key ideas in chapters 3 through 7 as an entire enterprise. Set a 20-mile march and commit to it. Fire bullets, then fire calibrated cannonballs. Practice all the elements of productive paranoia discussed in Leading Above the Death Line. Adhere to and selectively amend a SMAC recipe. Become highly attuned to luck and respond to every luck event, good or bad, with the question, what are we going to do to get a high return on this luck? If your team and enterprise succeed at all of these, it will matter less whether any single individual is a full-fledged 10Xer. Question. Does leading above the death line mean avoiding BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals, as we discussed them in the book Built to Last? Answer. No. Roald Amundsen en route to the South Pole and David Brashears with his IMAX camera on Everest were certainly pursuing BHAGs, as were the 10X leaders in our research study companies. The task is to pursue BHAGs and stay above the death line. Question. How is the 10X concept, fire bullets, then cannonballs, different from the built-to-last concept, try a lot of stuff and keep what works? Answer. The two ideas do overlap, but the key additional insight from the 10X research is that 10Xers follow up successful bullets with cannonballs. Trying a lot of stuff is, in essence, firing bullets. But keeping what works is not the same thing as making a big bet to fully exploit what you have learned from firing a bullet. That's what cannonballs are for. Question. What are the implications for innovation-driven economies of your finding that 10X cases didn't always out-innovate the comparison companies? Answer. Our research indicates that treating innovation alone as the silver bullet for achieving a competitive advantage would be naive and unwise. We conclude that 10X success requires the ability to scale innovation with great consistency by blending creativity and discipline to build organizations that turn innovation into sustained great performance. This is the Intel story. It's also the Southwest story, the Microsoft story, the Amgen story, the Stryker story, the Biomet story, the Progressive story, the story of the resurgence of Genentech under Levinson, and even the Apple story during its best years. If an enterprise, whether a company or a nation, retains its creativity yet loses discipline, increases pioneering innovation, yet forgets how to multiply that innovation at scale and at minimum cost, our research indicates that enterprise will be at risk. Question. You mentioned the genius of the and a few times in the text. What is the genius of the and how does it apply here? Answer. We found in the Built to Last study that leaders of enduring great companies are comfortable with paradox, having the ability to embrace two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time. They don't oppress themselves with what we call the tyranny of the or, which pushes people to believe that things must be either A or B, but not both. Instead, the best leaders liberate themselves with the genius of the and, the ability to embrace both extremes of a number of dimensions at the same time. In the words of F. Scott Fitzgerald, the test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. In the 10X study, we found extensive evidence of the genius of the and. For example, disciplined and creative. Empirical validation and bold moves. Prudence and BHAGs, big, hairy, audacious goals. Paranoid and courageous. Ferociously ambitious and not egocentric. Severe performance standards, no excuses. And never going too far, able to hold back. On a 20-mile march and fire bullets, then cannonballs. Threshold innovation and one fad behind. Cannot predict the future and prepared for what they cannot predict. Go slow when they can and go fast when they must. Disciplined thought and decisive action. Zoom out and zoom in. Adhering to a smack recipe and amending a smack recipe. Consistency and change. Never count on luck and get a high ROL, return on luck, when luck comes. Question, how do you respond to critics of your research findings who point to the failings of previously great companies you've researched and written about? Answer. As we discussed in Chapter 1, our research is based upon studying specific dynastic eras of performance, like studying the greatest sports dynasties in history. That some sports dynasties later ceased to be dynasties would be irrelevant to the overall analysis of what it takes to build a great sports dynasty. Again, we can study the John Wooden era of the UCLA Bruins, and just because the Bruins in a later era are not the same team, does not negate what we would learn by studying the Bruins under Wooden. Question: can this book help companies avoid the five stages of decline outlined in How the Mighty Fall? Answer: yes. In fact, the comparison cases in this study that fell from potential greatness, PSA, Safeco, USSC, Genentech in the pre-Levinson era, and Apple before the return of Steve Jobs, all showed elements of stages 1 through 4 of decline, and some went all the way to stage 5. To review, those 5 stages of decline that we write about in How the Mighty Fall are stage 1, hubris born of success; stage 2, undisciplined pursuit of more, leading to stage 3, denial of risk and peril, followed by stage 4, grasping for salvation, and eventually leads to stage 5, capitulation to irrelevance or death. The 10X concepts in this work can play a significant role in staving off the stages of decline. Doing a 20-mile march, avoiding uncalibrated cannonballs, and adhering to a SMAC recipe help companies stay out of stage 2. Leading above the death line concepts, amassing oxygen canisters, bounding risk, and zooming out and zooming in directly aid in keeping stage 3 at bay. Carefully amending a SMAC recipe rather than inciting wholesale reactive revolution enables companies to avoid stage 4. As for the peril of stage 1, hubris, those who truly practice productive paranoia never feel they're invincible. They always fear that potential doom lurks just around the corner. Question: how did you two, Jim and Morton, begin your working partnership, and why did you do this research project as a team? Answer: Morton and I first met at Stanford Graduate School of Business in 1991. I was then teaching entrepreneurship and small business, and my colleague, Professor Jerry Porras, and I had embarked on the Built to Last research project. Morton joined our research team en route to receiving his PhD. Later, Morton went on to become a faculty member at Harvard Business School, and he contributed critical input on the research methods and study designs for the Good to Great project. Morton and I had always talked about collaborating on a project from the ground up if we discovered a mutually fascinating question. The question behind this book, why some thrive in the face of immense uncertainty, even chaos, and others do not, had been gestating in both of our minds for years, but it had been pushed to the background while working on other projects. Then in the aftermath of 9/11 and the bursting stock bubble, watching the exponential rise of global competition and the relentless onslaught of technological disruption, hearing the rising chant of change, 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 the question asserted itself. We both came to believe that uncertainty is permanent. Chaotic times are normal. Change is accelerating, and instability will likely characterize the rest of our lives. So, we joined forces. Question: do you see Great by Choice as about defining and thriving in a new normal? Answer: no. The premise behind this work is that instability is chronic, uncertainty is permanent, change is accelerating, disruption is common, and we can neither predict nor govern events. We believe there will be no new normal. There will only be a continuous series of not normal times. The dominant pattern of history isn't stability, but instability and disruption. Those of us who came of age amidst stable prosperity in developed economies in the second half of the 20th century would be wise to recognize that we grew up in a historical aberration. How many times in history do people operate inside a seemingly safe cocoon during an era of relative peace, while riding one of the most sustained economic booms of all time? For those of us who grew up in such environments, and especially for those who grew up in the United States, nearly all our personal experience lies within a rarefied slice of overall human history, very unlikely to repeat itself in the 21st century and beyond. Question: how widely applicable is the question underlying this study? Do you see it as universal? Answer: stop to think about your own situation or organization and consider the following question. Rate the context in which you operate today on a 1 to 10 scale. A rating of 1 means you face no big forces outside your control. Nothing moves particularly fast. You can predict most of what's going to happen. Everything feels stable and certain. And there's nothing out there that can significantly alter your trajectory, good or bad. At the other end of the continuum, a rating of 10 means you face tremendous, fast-moving, unpredictable forces outside of your control that elicit feelings of uncertainty and instability, and that can have a huge impact, good or bad, on your trajectory. How would you rate your environment? Stable or unstable? Certain or uncertain? Predictable or unpredictable? In your control or not? More like a 3 or more like an 8? It doesn't matter whether we're discussing this question with small company entrepreneurs, Army generals, K-12 educators, church leaders, membership associations, police chiefs, city managers, healthcare professionals, philanthropists, CIOs, CFOs, CEOs, or even individuals concerned about their jobs and families. When we ask this question, we get a remarkably consistent pattern of answers. After giving people a moment to reflect, we ask for a show of hands. How many have a score of less than 5? Almost no hands go up. How many have a score of 5 or 6? A few hands go up. How many have a score of 7 or 8? More than half the people in the room raise their hands. How many have a score of 9 or 10? The remaining people raise their hands. The question of what it takes to thrive in the face of uncertainty, even chaos, feels relevant to every industry and every social sector we've encountered so far. Question: do you see the causes of chaos and uncertainty as primarily economic? Answer: not entirely. Certainly there are economic drivers, such as increased global competition, volatile capital markets, and rapidly evolving business models. But clearly, the sources of instability come from far outside economics, such as government regulation or deregulation, undisciplined government spending, unpredictable political risk, disruptive technologies, new media, the amplifying effect of a 24-hour news cycle, natural disasters, terrorism, energy shocks, climate change, political upheaval in emerging countries, and so on. And there will be entirely new disruptions and chaotic forces as yet unforeseen. Question: Do you see this book as about the past or the future? Answer. We've studied the past, but we see this book as having great relevance for leading in the future. Our strategy was to carefully examine companies that had achieved greatness in the most uncertain and chaotic industries, and to glean the general principles for thriving in such environments so that they can be applied by all enterprises dealing with the uncertainty and episodes of chaos in the 21st century. Question. My world feels fairly stable right now. Does all of this apply to me? Answer. Remember a lesson from chapter 5. It's what you do before the storm comes that most determines how well you'll do when the storm comes. Those who fail to plan and prepare for instability, disruption, and chaos in advance tend to suffer more when their environments shift from stability to turbulence. Question. Do the 10X concepts apply as much to the social sectors as the good to great ideas? Answer. While conducting this research, we simultaneously worked with leaders from a wide range of social sectors, including K-12 education, higher education, churches, nonprofit hospitals, the military, police forces, government, city, county, state, and national, museums, orchestras, social safety nets such as hunger and homelessness-related organizations, youth programs, and a wide range of cause-driven nonprofits. Like business leaders, they all face big forces outside their control, high degrees of uncertainty, fast-moving events, dangerous threats, and huge disruptive opportunities. We found these ideas to be directly relevant for them, albeit with unique translation to each sector. Question. Do you see this work as being primarily about navigating in times of austerity and crisis? Answer. No. This is not a book on crisis management, nor is it about thriving amidst recession or even economic calamity. Crises and difficult times are simply special case scenarios of a more general condition of unrelenting instability and chronic uncertainty, whether in good times or bad. In fact, disruptive opportunity is just as dangerous as disruptive threat. Times of explosive growth are at least as difficult to navigate as times of economic austerity. Keep in mind some of the industries we studied. Software, computers, microelectronics, biotechnology, insurance, and medical devices. These industries were full of spectacular growth and opportunity, while also being uncertain, chaotic, and even dangerous. Consider computer software. In 1983, Industry Week magazine published a story entitled Software Sparks a Gold Rush and listed the top 16 personal computer software companies. All 16 sat right on the nose cone of a rocket about to take off, a nascent industry that would sell more than 1 billion personal computers worldwide by the early 2000s. Yet along the way, most of the early leaders lost their independence, and some died outright. Of the 16 leaders listed in the 1983 article, only 3 remained standing as independent companies at the time of this reading. The opportunity was huge. The amount of change was huge. And the resulting carnage was huge. If we're living in an age roiling with tumultuous opportunity, those who have the right tools and concepts and the discipline to employ them will pull even farther ahead. Those who don't will fall further behind. Many, despite the rich and robust opportunities, will get knocked out of the game entirely. Question: how did the 2008 financial meltdown affect your thinking for this study? Answer: it served only to reinforce the relevance of the study question. Very few people predicted the 2008 financial crisis. The next great disruption will come, and the next one after that, and the next one after that, forever. We cannot know with certainty what they'll be or when they'll come, but we can know with certainty that they will come. Question: are you more or less optimistic and hopeful after conducting this study? Answer: we're much more optimistic and hopeful. More than any of our prior research, this study shows that whether we prevail or fail, endure or die, depends more upon what we do than on what the world does to us. We take particular solace from the fact that every 10Xer made mistakes, even some very big mistakes, yet was able to self-correct, survive, and build greatness. Acknowledgements. We could not have completed this project without the small army of people who made significant contributions of time and intellect. We had a wonderful team of research assistants. They are smart, curious, irreverent, fanatically disciplined people who are a joy to work with. We would like to thank the following members of the ChimpWorks research team: Robin Bittner for multiple years of marching on a range of analyses, Kyle Blackmer for turbulence insights, Brad Caldwell for Biomet and Southwest analyses, Adam Cederberg for company selection and IPO analyses, Lauren Cougier for 10X company updates and title analysis, Terrence Cummings, a.k.a. Grande, for thousands of hours invested in dozens of pieces of the project, Daniel DeWispolare for Amgen analysis, Todd Driver for 10X leader analyses and 10X company updates, Michael Graham for comparison selection and comparative analyses, Eric Hagen for the IPO list smack check and his big brain contributions, Ryan Hall for a range of quantitative analyses, Beth Hartman for turbulence analyses and company selections, Deborah Knox for industry turbulence analyses and extensive IPO analysis, Bettina Koski for industry turbulence analyses, Michael Lane for comparison selection and comparative analyses, Laura Lee Linfield for company updates and multiple years of smack work, Nicholas M. Osgood for industry turbulence analyses, Catherine Patterson for comparison selections and comparative analyses, Matthew Unangst for backup analyses and Moore's Law research, Nathaniel Natty Zola for becoming the guru of Southwest Airlines versus Pacific Southwest Airlines. For Morton's research assistants, we thank Chris Allen for data analyses, Mohammed Rashid Ansari for industry analyses, Jane Brocklehurst for research support, Atrace Yoying Chang for fact-checking, Hendrika Escoffier for research support, Royzen Kelly for research support, Chidima Silberzon for financial data and analyses, Philippe Silberzon for Microsoft and Apple analyses, William Simpson for data analyses, Gina Carioja Zighetti for data analyses in company selections, Nana von Bernuth for years of amazing effort and commitment in conducting a wide range of indispensable analyses, and James Zeitler for data analyses. We are indebted to our critical readers who invested hours in reading drafts of the manuscript, criticizing the work, offering suggestions, and pushing at every turn to make the work better. For their candor, insight, and perspective, we would like to thank Ron Adner, Joel T. Allison, FACHE, Chris Barbary, Gerald Jerry Bell, Daryl Billington, Kyle Blackmer, John M. Bremen, William P. Buchanan, Scott Calder, Robin Capehart, Scott Cederberg, Brian Cornell, Lauren Couget, Jeff Donnelly, Todd Driver, David R. Duncan, Mike Faith, Andrew Feiler, Claudio Fernandez Araz, Andrew Fimiano, Christopher Foreman, John Foster, Dick Frost, Itzik Goldberger, Michael Graham, Ed Greenberg, Eric Hagen, Becky Hall, Ryan Hall, Beth Hartman, Liz Heron, John B. Hess, John G. Hill, Kim Hollingsworth Taylor, Thomas F. Hornbeam, M.D., Lane Hornung, Zane Huffman, Christine Jones, Scott Jones, David D. Kennedy, Alan Casey, Bettina Koski, Eva M.H. Christensen, Brian C. Larson, Kyle Lefkoff, Jim Linfield, father of chimp Laura Lee, Ed Ludwig, Westar H. McLaren, David Maxwell, Kevin McGarvey, M.D., M.B.A., Bill McNabb, Ann Worley Moulter, also known as SFVG, Michael James Moulter, Clarence Otis Jr., Larry Pensack, Jerry Peterson, Amy Pressman, Sam Presti, Michael Prouding, David P. Ray, Jim Reed, Neville Richardson, Sarah Richardson, David G. Salyers, Kim Sanchez Real, Vijay Sate, Kagan Scanlon, Dirk Schlimm, William F. Schuster, Annabelle Shires, Allison Sinclair, Tim Tassopoulos, Kevin Tweel, Gene Taylor, Tom Tierney, Nicole Toomey Davis, Matthew Unangst, Nana von Bernuth, H. Lawrence Webb, David Weekly, Chuck Wexler, Dave Witherow, and Nathaniel Natty Zola. We also thank Constance Hale, Jeffrey Martin, and Philippe Simoes dos Santos for their special attention to the research methods section. In addition, we would like to thank Salvatore D. Fazzolari, Dennis Godcharles, Ben R. Liddle Jr., Evan Shapiro, Roy M. Spence Jr., and Jim Weddle for helpful dialogue and feedback. We would also like to thank the Transportation Library at Northwestern University for access to PSA's annual reports, Betty Grebe and Carol Christman at the University of Colorado William M. White Business Library, the Center for Research and Security Pricing, CRISP, Booth School of Business at the University of Chicago for its quality data and excellent service, Jasjit Singh for patent data and insights, Dennis Bale and Lori Drabaugh for the Roving Office, Lee Wilbanks for joining our early concept debates, Alan Weber for great moments of conversation that sparked key ideas, Jim Logan for enduring the seemingly endless journey, Tommy Caldwell for testing 10Xer ideas on sheer cliff walls, and all of Jim's personal band of brothers. Morton is especially thankful to Harvard Business School, INSEAD, and University of California, Berkeley, where he held academic positions during the time of this research. We thank Deborah Knox for editing the final text. pushing us for consistency and clarity, continually challenging our ideas, and zooming out on the big ideas, while also zooming in on the details. We thank James J. Robb for his graphics expertise, unbounded creativity, and enduring friendship. We thank Janet Brockett for her creative spark and design genius. We thank Karen Maroney for being a far-seeing guide through treacherous territory. We thank Peter M. Moldave for his dedicated and considered counsel. We thank Hollis Heimbach for believing in this work early on, tirelessly navigating the changing landscape of publishing, and working in a true spirit of partnership. We thank Peter Ginsburg for his unbroken track record at bringing together creative and unusual arrangements that benefit everyone involved. We thank Prasanna Bishop for spectacular sound studio and superb editing. We thank members of the ChimpWorks home team who make it possible for Jim to focus on doing huge creative projects. For their efforts early in the project, we thank Brian J. Bagley, Patrick Blakemore, Taffy Hightower, Vicky Mosur Osgood, and Laura Suchet. We thank Jeff Dale for his measured and wise perspective as our strategic paratrooper. Judy Dunkley for her dedication to precision and accuracy and for her joyful worrying. Michael Lane for his dedicated years of being productively irreverent. Sue Barlow-Toll for serving as our director of operations and scampering down many a rabbit hole. And Kathy Warland Turner for being Jim's right arm and exercising her wonderful ability to create friends and build relationships. We thank Robin Bittner and Laura Linfield for their heroic dedication to the project in its final year. They brought light and energy to our team while being opers of the first order. Finally, we owe an incalculable debt to our respective life partners, Joanne Ernst and Helene Henson, for their unyielding support, severest criticism, and endurance as we marched through the 9 years of this project. This work would not exist without them. This is Jim Collins. This production of Great by Choice, Uncertainty, Chaos, and Luck, Why Some Thrive Despite Them All, was recorded at Akashic Recording in Boulder, Colorado. It was engineered and edited by Prasanna Bishop and mastered by Common Mode. The director and executive producer was Karen Jokonski. Text copyright 2011 by Jim Collins and Morton T. Hansen. Production copyright 2011 by HarperCollins Publishers. All rights reserved. Thank you for listening.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.